elevator on the Connecticut Turnpike. He said, then laughed and pushed stop. There is more on the tape, a little more, but that is the final statement of any coherence, the final statement, that is, to which a clear meaning can be ascribed. Mike turned on his heels and looked at the pictures, still hanging perfectly straight, good little pictures that they were. That still life, though, what an ugly fucking thing that was. He pushed record and spoke two words, "Fuming oranges," into the minicorder. Then he turned it off again and walked across the room to the door leading into the bedroom. He paused by the evening dress lady and reached into the darkness, feeling for the light switch. He had just one moment to register, "It feels like skin, like old dead skin." Something wrong with the wallpaper under his sliding palm, and then his fingers found the switch. The bedroom was flooded with yellow light from another of those ceiling fixtures buried in hanging glass baubles. The bed was a double, hiding under a yellow-orange coverlet. "Why say hiding?" Mike asked the minicorder, then pushed the stop button again. He stepped in, fascinated by the fuming desert of the coverlet, by the tumorous bulges of the pillows beneath it. "Sleep there?" "Not at all, sir. It would be like sleeping inside that goddamn still life, sleeping in that horrible hot Paul Bowles room you couldn't quite see, a room for lunatic expatriate Englishmen who were blind from syphilis caught while fucking their mothers, the film version starring either Lawrence Harvey or Jeremy Irons, one of those actors you just naturally associated with unnatural acts." Mike pushed record. The little red eye came on. He said, "Oedipus on the Orpheum circuit," into the mic, then pushed stop again. He approached the bed. The coverlet gleamed yellow-orange. The wallpaper, perhaps cream-colored by daylight, had picked up the yellow-orange glow of the coverlet. There was a little night table to either side of the bed. On one was a telephone, black and large and equipped with a dial. The finger holes in the dial looked like surprised white eyes. On the other table was a dish with a plum on it. Mike pushed record and said, "That isn't a real plum. That's a plastic plum." He pushed stop again. On the bed itself was a doorknob menu. Mike sidled up one side of the bed, being quite careful to touch neither the bed or the wall, and picked the menu up. He tried not to touch the coverlet either, but the tips of his fingers brushed it, and he moaned. It was soft in some terrible wrong way. Nevertheless, he picked the menu up. It was in French, and although it had been years since he had studied the language, one of the breakfast items appeared to be birds roasted in shit. "That at least sounds like something the French might eat," he thought, and uttered a wild, distracted laugh. He closed his eyes and opened them. The menu was in Russian. He closed his eyes and opened them. The menu was in Italian. Closed his eyes, opened them. There was no menu. There was a picture of a screaming little woodcut boy looking back over his shoulder at the woodcut wolf, which had swallowed his left leg up to the knee. The wolf's ears were laid back, and he looked like a terrier with its favorite toy. "I don't see that," Mike thought, and of course he didn't. Without closing his eyes, he saw neat lines of English, each line listing a different breakfast temptation. Eggs, waffles, fresh berries, no birds roasted in shit. Still, he turned around and very slowly edged himself out of the little space between the wall and the bed, a space that now felt as narrow as a grave. His heart was beating so hard that he could feel it in his neck and wrists as well as in his chest. His eyes were throbbing in their sockets. 1408 was wrong. Yes, indeed. 1408 was very wrong. Olin had said something about poison gas, and that was what Mike felt like, someone who has been gassed or forced to smoke strong hashish laced with insect poison. Olin had done this, of course, probably with the active laughing connivance of the security people, pumped his special poison gas up through the vents. Just because he could see no vents didn't mean the vents weren't there. Mike looked around the bedroom with wide, frightened eyes. There was no plum on the end table to the left of the bed, no plate either. The table was bare. He turned, started for the door leading back to the living room, and stopped. There was a picture on the wall. He couldn't be absolutely sure. In his present state, he couldn't be absolutely sure of his own name. But he was fairly sure that there had been no picture there when he first came in. It was a still life. A single plum sat on a tin plate in the middle of an old plank table. The light falling across the plum and the plate was a feverish yellow-orange. Tango light, he thought. The kind of light that makes the dead get up out of their graves and tango. The kind of light... I have to get out of here, he whispered, and blundered back into the living room. He became aware that his shoes had begun to make odd smooching sounds, as if the floor beneath them were growing soft. The pictures on the living room wall were crooked again, and there were other changes as well. The lady on the stairs had pulled down the top of her gown, baring her breasts. She held one in each hand. A drop of blood hung from each nipple. She was staring directly into Mike's eyes and grinning ferociously. Her teeth were filed to cannibal points. At the rail of the sailing ship, the tars had been replaced by a line of pallid men and women. The man on the far left, nearest the ship's bow, wore a brown wool suit and held a derby hat in one hand. His hair was slicked to his brow and parted in the middle. His face was shocked and vacant. Mike knew his name, Kevin O'Malley, this room's first occupant, a sewing machine salesman who had jumped in October of 1910. To O'Malley's left were the others who had died here, all with that same vacant, shocked expression. It made them look related, all members of the same inbred and cataclysmically retarded family. In the picture where the fruit had been, there was now a severed human head. Yellow-orange light swam off the sunken cheeks, the sagging lips, the upturned glazing eyes, the cigarette parked behind the right ear. Mike blundered toward the door, his feet smooching and now actually seeming to stick a little at each step. The door wouldn't open, of course. The chain hung unengaged. The thumb bolt stood straight up like clock hands pointing to 6 o'clock, but the door wouldn't open. Breathing rapidly, Mike turned from it and waited, that was what it felt like, across the room to the writing desk. He could see the curtains beside the window he had cracked open, waving desultorily, but he could feel no fresh air against his face. It was as though the room were swallowing it. He could still hear horns on Fifth, but they were now very distant. Did he still hear the saxophone? If so, the room had stolen its sweetness and melody and left only an atonal reedy drone like the wind blowing across a hole in a dead man's neck or a pop bottle filled with severed fingers or... Stop it, he tried to say, but he could no longer speak. His heart was hammering at a terrible pace. If it went much faster, it would explode. His minicorder, faithful companion of many case expeditions, was no longer in his hand. He had left it somewhere. In the bedroom? If it was in the bedroom, it was probably gone by now, swallowed by the room. When it was digested, it would be excreted into one of the pictures. Gasping for breath like a runner nearing the end of a long race, Mike put a hand to his chest, as if to soothe his heart. What he felt in the left breast pocket of his gaudy shirt was the small square shape of the minicorder. The feel of it, so solid and known, steadied him a little, brought him back a little. He became aware that he was humming, and that the room seemed to be humming back at him, as if myriad mouths were concealed beneath its smoothly nasty wallpaper. He was aware that his stomach was now so nauseated that it seemed to be swinging in its own greasy hammock. He could feel the air crowding against his ears in soft, coagulating clots, and it made him think of how fudge was when it reached the soft ball stage. But he was back a little, enough to be positive of one thing. He had to call for help while there was still time. The thought of Olin smirking, in his deferential New York hotel manager way, and saying, "I told you so," didn't bother him. And the idea that Olin had somehow induced these strange perceptions and horrible fears by chemical means had entirely left his mind. It was the room. It was the goddamned room. He meant to jab out a hand to the old-fashioned telephone, the twin of the one in the bedroom, and snatch it up. Instead, he watched his arm descend to the table in a kind of delirious slow motion. So like the arm of a diver, he almost expected to see bubbles rising from it. He closed his fingers around the handset and picked it up. His other hand dove, as deliberately as the first, and dialed O. As he put the handset of the phone against his ear, he heard a series of clicks as the dial spun back to its original position. It sounded like the wheel on Wheel of Fortune. Do you want to spin, or do you want to solve the puzzle? Remember that if you try to solve the puzzle and fail, you will be put out into the snow beside the Connecticut Turnpike, and the wolves will eat you. There was no ring in his ear. Instead, a harsh voice simply began speaking. This is nine. Nine. This is nine. Nine. This is ten. Ten. We have killed your friends. Every friend is now dead. This is six. Six. Mike listened with growing horror, not at what the voice was saying, but at its rasping emptiness. It was not a machine-generated voice, but it wasn't a human voice either. It was the voice of the room, the presence pouring out of the walls and the floor, the presence speaking to him from the telephone, had nothing in common with any haunting or paranormal event he had ever read about. There was something alien here. No, not here yet, but coming. It's hungry, and your dinner. The phone fell from his relaxing fingers, and he turned around. It swung at the end of its cord the way his stomach was swinging back and forth inside him, and he could still hear that voice rasping out of the black. 18! This is now 18! Take cover when the siren sounds. This is 4! 4! He was not aware of taking the cigarette from behind his ear and putting it in his mouth, or of fumbling the book of matches with the old-fashioned gold frog dormant on it out of his bright shirt's right breast pocket, not aware that, after 9 years, he had finally decided to have a smoke. Before him, the room had begun to melt. It was sagging out of its right angles and straight lines, not into curves, but into strange Moorish arcs that hurt his eyes. The glass chandelier in the center of the ceiling began to sag like a thick glob of spit. The pictures began to bend, turning into shapes like the windshields of old cars. From behind the glass of the picture by the door leading into the bedroom, the 20s woman with the bleeding nipples and grinning cannibal teeth whirled around and ran back up the stairs, going with the jerky, delirious, high knee-pistoning of a vamp in a silent movie. The telephone continued to grind and spit, the voice coming from it now the voice of an electric hair clipper that has learned how to talk. 5! This is 5! Ignore the siren. Even if you leave this room, you can never leave this room. 8! This is 8! The door to the bedroom and the door to the hall had begun to collapse downward, widening in the middle and becoming doorways for beings possessed of unspeakable shapes. The light began to grow bright and hot, filling the room with that yellow-orange glow. Now he could see rips in the wallpaper, black pores that quickly grew to become mouths. The floor sank into a concave arc, and now he could hear it coming, the dweller in the room behind the room, the thing in the walls, the owner of the buzzing voice. 6! The phone screamed. 6! This is 6! This is goddamn fucking 6! He looked down at the matchbook in his hand, the one he had plucked out of the bedroom ashtray. Funny old doorman. Funny old cars with their big chrome grills. And words running across the bottom that he hadn't seen in a long time, because now the strip of abrasive stuff was always on the back. Close cover before striking. Without thinking about it, he no longer could think, Mike Enslin tore out a single match, allowing the cigarette to drop out of his mouth at the same time. He struck the match and immediately touched it to the others in the book. There was a pfft sound, a strong whiff of burning sulfur that went into his head like a whiff of smelling salts, and a bright flare of match heads. And again, without so much as a single thought, Mike held the flaring bouquet of fire against the front of his shirt. It was a cheap thing made in Korea or Cambodia or Borneo, old now. It caught fire at once. Before the flames could blaze up in front of his eyes, rendering the room once more unstable, Mike saw it clearly, like a man who is awakened from a nightmare, only to find the nightmare all around him. His head was clear. The strong whiff of sulfur and the sudden rising heat from his shirt had done that much, but the room maintained its insanely Moorish aspect. Moorish was wrong, not even very close, but it was the only word that seemed even to reach toward what had happened here, what was still happening. He was in a melting, rotting cave full of swoops and mad tilts. The door to the bedroom had become the door to some sarcophagal inner chamber. And to his left, where the picture of the fruit had been, the wall was bulging outward toward him, splitting open in those long cracks that gaped like mouths, opening on a world from which something was now approaching. Mike Enslin could hear its slobbering, avid breath, and smell something alive and dangerous. It smelled a little like the lion house in the... Then flame scorched the undershelf of his chin, banishing thought. The heat rising from his blazing shirt put that waver back into the world, and as he began to smell the crispy aroma of his chest hair starting to fry, Mike again bolted across the sagging rug to the hall door. An insectal buzzing sound had begun to sweat out of the walls. The yellow-orange light was steadily brightening, as if a hand were turning up an invisible rheostat. But this time, when he reached the door and turned the knob, the door opened. It was as if the thing behind the bulging wall had no use for a burning man, did not, perhaps, relish cooked meat. 3. A popular song from the 50s suggests that love makes the world go round, but coincidence would probably be a better bet. Rufus Dearborn, who was staying that night in room 1414 up near the elevators, was a salesman for the Singer Sewing Machine Company, in town from Texas to talk about moving up to an executive position. And so it happened that 90 or so years after room 1408's first occupant jumped to his death, another sewing machine salesman saved the life of the man who had come to write about the purportedly haunted room. Or perhaps that is an exaggeration. Mike Enslin might have lived even if no one, especially a fellow on his way back from a visit to the ice machine, had been in the hallway at that moment. Having your shirt catch fire is no joke, though, and he certainly would have been burned much more severely and extensively if not for Dearborn, who thought fast and moved even faster. Not that Dearborn ever remembered exactly what happened. He constructed a coherent enough story for the newspapers and TV cameras. He liked the idea of being a hero very much, and it certainly did no harm to his executive aspirations. And he clearly remembered seeing the man on fire lunge out into the hall, but after that, everything was a blur. Thinking about it was like trying to reconstruct the things you had done during the vilest, deepest drunk of your life. One thing he was sure of, but didn't tell any of the reporters because it made no sense. The burning man's scream seemed to grow in volume, as if he were a stereo that was being turned up. He was right there in front of Dearborn, and the pitch of the scream never changed, but the volume most certainly did. It was as if the man were some incredibly loud object that was just arriving here. Dearborn ran down the hall with the full ice bucket in his hand. The burning man... "It was just his shirt on fire. I saw that right away," he told the reporters. Struck the door opposite the room he had come out of, rebounded, staggered, and fell to his knees. That was when Dearborn reached him. He put his foot on the burning shoulder of the screaming man's shirt and pushed him over onto the hall carpet. Then he dumped the contents of the ice bucket onto him. These things were blurred in his memory, but accessible. He was aware that the burning shirt seemed to be casting far too much light, a sweltering yellow-orange light that made him think of a trip he and his brother had made to Australia 2 years before. They had rented an all-wheel drive and had taken off across the Great Australian Desert. The few natives called it the Great Australian Bugger-All, the Dearborn brothers discovered. A hell of a trip. Great, but spooky. Especially the big rock in the middle, Ayers Rock. They had reached it right around sunset, and the light on its many faces was like this, hot and strange. Not really what you thought of as earthlight at all. He dropped beside the burning man, who was now only the smoldering man, the covered with ice cubes man, and rolled him over to stifle the flames reaching around to the back of the shirt. When he did, he saw the skin on the left side of the man's neck had gone a smoky, bubbly red, and the lobe of his ear on that side had melted a little. But otherwise... otherwise... Dearborn looked up, and it seemed... this was crazy, but it seemed the door to the room the man had come out of was filled with the burning light of an Australian sundown, the hot light of an empty place where things no man has ever seen might live. It was terrible, that light, and the low buzzing, like an electric clipper that was trying desperately to speak. But it was fascinating, too. He wanted to go into it. He wanted to see what was behind it. Perhaps Mike saved Dearborn's life as well. He was certainly aware that Dearborn was getting up, as if Mike no longer held any interest for him, and that his face was filled with the blazing, pulsing light coming out of 1408. He remembered this better than Dearborn later did himself, but of course, Roof Dearborn had not been reduced to setting himself on fire in order to survive. Mike grabbed the cuff of Dearborn's slacks.
"Don't go in there,"
he said in a cracked, smoky voice.
"You'll never come out."
Dearborn stopped, looking down at the reddening, blistering face of the man on the carpet.
"It's haunted," Mike said.
And as if the words had been a talisman, the door of room 1408 slammed furiously shut, cutting off the light, cutting off the terrible buzz that was almost words. Rufus Dearborn, one of Singer Sewing Machine's finest, ran down to the elevators and pulled the fire alarm. 4. There's an interesting picture of Mike Enslin in Treating the Burn Victim, a Diagnostic Approach, the 16th edition of which appeared about 16 months after Mike's short stay in room 1408 of the Hotel Dolphin. The photo shows just his torso, but it's Mike all right. One can tell by the white square on the left side of his chest. The flesh all around it is an angry red, actually blistered into second-degree burns in some places. The white square marks the left breast pocket of the shirt he was wearing that night, the lucky shirt, with his mini-quarter in the pocket. The mini-quarter itself melted around the corners, but it still works, and the tape inside it was fine. It's the things on it which are not fine. After listening to it 3 or 4 times, Mike's agent, Sam Farrell, tossed it into his wall safe, refusing to acknowledge the goose flesh all over his tanned, scrawny arms. In that wall safe, the tape has stayed ever since. Farrell has no urge to take it out and play it again, not for himself, not for his curious friends, some of whom would cheerfully kill to hear it. New York publishing is a small community, and word gets around. He doesn't like Mike's voice on the tape. He doesn't like the stuff that voice is saying. "My brother was actually eaten by wolves one winter on the Connecticut Turnpike. What in God's name is that supposed to mean?" And most of all, he doesn't like the background sounds on the tape. A kind of liquid smooshing that sometimes sounds like clothes churning around in an oversudged washer, sometimes like one of those old electric hair clippers, and sometimes, weirdly, like a voice. While Mike was still in the hospital, a man named Olin, the manager of the goddamned hotel, if you please, came and asked Sam Farrell if he could listen to that tape. Farrell said no, he couldn't. What Olin could do was take himself on out of the agent's office at a rapid hike and thank God all the way back to the flea bag where he worked that Mike Enslin had decided not to sue either the hotel or Olin for negligence. "I tried to persuade him not to go in," Olin said quietly. A man who spent most of his working days listening to tired travelers and petulant guests bitch about everything from their rooms to the magazine selection in the newsstand, he wasn't much perturbed by Farrell's rancor. "I tried everything in my power. If anyone was negligent that night, Mr. Farrell, it was your client. He believed too much in nothing. Very unwise behavior. Very unsafe behavior. I would guess he has changed somewhat in that regard." In spite of Farrell's distaste for the tape, he would like Mike to listen to it, acknowledge it, perhaps use it as a pad from which to launch a new book. There is a book in What Happened to Mike. Farrell knows it. Not just a chapter, a 40-page case history, but an entire book, one that might outsell all three of the 10 Nights books combined. And of course he doesn't believe Mike's assertion that he has finished not only with ghost tales, but with all writing. Writers say that from time to time, that's all. The occasional prima donna outburst is part of what makes writers in the first place. As for Mike Enslin himself, he got off lucky, all things considered, and he knows it. He could have been burned much more badly than he actually was. If not for Mr. Dearborn and his bucket of ice, he might have had 20 or even 30 different skin graft procedures to suffer through instead of only 4. His neck is scarred on the left side in spite of the grafts, but the doctors at the Boston Burn Institute tell him the scars will fade on their own. He also knows that the burns, painful as they were in the weeks and months after that night, were necessary. If not for the matches with "close cover before striking" written on the front, he would have died in 1408, and his end would have been unspeakable. To a coroner, it might have looked like a stroke or a heart attack, but the actual cause of death would have been much nastier. Much nastier. He was also lucky in having produced 3 popular books on ghosts and hauntings before actually running afoul of a place that is haunted. This he also knows. Sam Farrell may not believe Mike's life as a writer is over, but Sam doesn't need to. Mike knows it for both of them. He cannot so much as write a postcard without feeling cold all over his skin and being nauseated deep in the pit of his belly. Sometimes just looking at a pen or a tape recorder will make him think, "The pictures were crooked. I tried to straighten the pictures." He doesn't know what this means. He can't remember the pictures or anything else from room 1408, and he is glad. That is a mercy. His blood pressure isn't so good these days. His doctor told him that burn victims often develop problems with their blood pressure and put him on medication. His eyes trouble him. His optometrist told him to start taking Ocuvites. He has consistent back problems. His prostate has gotten too large. But he can deal with these things. He knows he isn't the first person to escape 1408 without really escaping. Olin tried to tell him. But it isn't all bad. At least he doesn't remember. Sometimes he has nightmares, quite often, in fact. Almost every goddamn night, in fact. But he rarely remembers them when he wakes up. A sense that things are rounding off at the corners, mostly, melting the way the corners of his mini-quarter melted. He lives on Long Island these days, and when the weather is good, he takes long walks on the beach. The closest he has ever come to articulating what he does remember about his 70-odd, very odd, minutes in 1408 was on one of those walks. "It was never human," he said to the incoming waves in a choked, halting voice. "Ghosts, at least ghosts, were once human. The thing in the wall, though, that thing." Time may improve it. He can and does hope for that. Time may fade it, as it will fade the scars on his neck. In the meantime, though, he sleeps with the lights on in his bedroom, so he will know at once where he is when he wakes up from the bad dreams. He has had all the phones taken out of the house, At some point, just below the place where his conscious mind seems able to go, he is afraid of picking the phone up and hearing a buzzing inhuman voice spit, "This is 9. 9. We have killed your friends. Every friend is now dead." And when the sun goes down on clear evening, he pulls every shade and blind and drape in the house. He sits like a man in a dark room until his watch tells him the light, even the last fading glow along the horizon, must be gone. He can't stand the light that comes at sunset, that yellow deepening to orange, like light in the desert.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Riding the Bullet by Stephen King. Read by Josh Hamilton.
I've never told anyone this story, and never thought I would. Not because I was afraid of being disbelieved, exactly, but because I was ashamed, and because it was mine. I've always felt that telling it would cheapen both me and the story itself, make it smaller and more mundane, no more than a camp counselor's ghost story told before lights out. I think I was also afraid that if I told it, heard it with my own ears, I might start to disbelieve it myself. But since my mother died, I haven't been able to sleep very well. I doze off and then snap back again, wide awake and shivering. Leaving the bedside lamp on helps, but not as much as you might think. There are so many more shadows at night. Have you ever noticed that? Even with the light on, there are so many shadows. The long ones could be the shadows of anything, you think. Anything at all. I was a junior at the University of Maine when Mrs. McCurdy called about Ma. My father died when I was too young to remember him, and I was an only child, so it was just Alan and Jean Parker against the world. Mrs. McCurdy, who lived just up the road, called to the apartment I shared with three other guys. She had gotten the number off the magnetic minder board Ma kept on her fridge.
"'Twas a stroke," she said in that long and drawling Yankee accent of hers. "Happened at the restaurant. But don't you go flying off all half-cocked. Doctor says it wa'n't too bad. She's awake, and she's talking."
"Yeah, but is she making sense?" I asked. I was trying to sound calm, even amused, but my heart was beating fast, and the living room suddenly felt too warm. I had the apartment all to myself. It was Wednesday, and both my roomies had classes all day.
"Oh, yeah. First thing she said was for me to call you, but not to scare you. That's pretty sensible, wouldn't you say?"
"Yeah. But of course I was scared. When someone calls and tells you your mother has been taken from work to the hospital in an ambulance, how else are you supposed to feel?"
"She said for you to stay right there and mind your schooling until the weekend. She said you could come then if you didn't have too much studying to do."
"Sure," I thought, "fat chance. I just stay here in this ratty, beer-smelling apartment while my mother lay in a hospital bed 100 miles south, maybe dying."
"She's still a young woman, your ma," Mrs. McCurdy said. "It's just that she's let herself get awful heavy these last few years, and she's got the hypertension, plus the cigarettes. She's going to have to give up the smokes." I doubted if she would, though, stroke or no stroke. And about that, I was right. My mother loved her smokes. I thanked Mrs. McCurdy for calling. "First thing I did when I got home," she said. "So, when are you coming, Alan? Saturday?"
There was a sly note in her voice that suggested she knew better. I looked out the window into a perfect afternoon in October. Bright blue New England sky over trees that were shaking down their yellow leaves onto Mill Street.
Then I glanced at my watch. 3:20. I'd just been on my way out to my 4 o'clock philosophy seminar when the phone rang. You kidding? I asked. I'll be there tonight. Her laughter was dry and a little cracked around the edges. Mrs. McCurdy was a great one to talk about giving up the cigarettes, her and her Winstons. Good boy. You'll go straight to the hospital, won't you? Then drive out to the house?
I guess so, yeah, I said.
I saw no sense in telling Mrs. McCurdy that there was something wrong with the transmission of my old car, and I wasn't going anywhere but the driveway for the foreseeable future. I'd hitchhike down to Lewiston, then out to our little house in Harlow if it wasn't too late. If it was, I'd snooze in one of the hospital lounges. It wouldn't be the first time I'd ridden my thumb home from school, or slept sitting up with my head leaning against a Coke machine for that matter. I'll make sure the key's under the red wheelbarrow, she said. You know where I mean, don't you?
Sure.
My mother kept an old red wheelbarrow by the door to the back shed. In the summer, it foamed with flowers. Thinking of it, for some reason, brought Mrs. McCurdy's news home to me as a true fact. My mother was in the hospital. The little house in Harlow where I'd grown up was going to be dark tonight. There was no one there to turn on the lights after the sun went down. Mrs. McCurdy could say she was young, but when you're just 21 yourself, 48 seems ancient.
Be careful, Alan. Don't speed.
My speed, of course, would be up to whoever I hooked a ride with, and I personally hoped that whoever it was would go like hell. As far as I was concerned, I couldn't get to Central Maine Medical Center fast enough. Still, there was no sense worrying Mrs. McCurdy. I won't. Thanks.
Welcome, she said. Your ma's going to be just fine. And won't she be some happy to see you?
I hung up, then scribbled a note saying what had happened and where I was going. I asked Hector Passmore, the more responsible of my roommates, to call my advisor and ask him to tell my instructors what was up so I wouldn't get whacked for cutting. Two or three of my teachers were real bears about that. Then I stuffed a change of clothes into my backpack, added my dog-eared copy of Introduction to Philosophy, and headed out. I dropped the course the following week, although I'd been doing quite well in it. The way I looked at the world changed that night, changed quite a lot, and nothing in my philosophy textbook seemed to fit the changes. I came to understand that there are things underneath, you see. Underneath. And no book can explain what they are. I think that sometimes it's best to just forget those things are there. If you can, that is. It's 120 miles from the University of Maine in Orono to Lewiston in Androscoggin County, and the quickest way to get there is by I-95. The turnpike isn't such a good road to take if you're hitchhiking, though. The state police are apt to boot anyone they see off. Even if you're just standing on the ramp, they give you the boot. And if the same cop catches you twice, he's apt to write you a ticket as well. So I took Route 68, which winds southwest from Bangor. It's a pretty well-traveled road, and if you don't look like an out-and-out psycho, you can usually do quite well. The cops leave you alone, too, for the most part. My first lift was with a morose insurance man, and took me as far as Newport. I stood at the intersection of Route 68 and Route 2 for about 20 minutes, then got a ride with an elderly gentleman who was on his way to Bodenham. He kept grabbing at his crotch as he drove. It was as if he was trying to catch something that was running around in there.
My wife always told me I'd wind up in the ditch with a knife in my back if I kept on picking up hitchhikers, he said. But when I see a young fella standing at the side of the road, I always remember my own younger days. Rode my thumb quite a bit, so I did. Rode the rods, too. And look at this, her dead 4 year, me still a-going. Driving the same old Dodge. I miss her something terrible.
He snatched at his crotch.
Where you headed, son?
I told him I was going to Lewiston and why.
That's terrible, he said. Your ma, I'm so sorry.
His sympathy was so strong and spontaneous that it made the corners of my eyes prickle. I blinked the tears back. The last thing in the world I wanted was to burst out crying in this old man's old car, which rattled and wallowed and smelled quite strongly of pee.
Mrs. McCurdy, the lady who called me, said it isn't that serious. My mother's still young, only 48.
Still, a stroke.
He was genuinely dismayed. He snatched at the baggy crotch of his green pants again, yanking with an old man's oversized claw-like hand.
A stroke's always serious. Son, I'd take you to the CMMC myself, drive you right up to the front door. If I hadn't promised my brother Ralph, I'd take him up to the nursing home in Gates. His wife's there. She has that forgetting disease. I can't think what in the world they call it. Anderson's or Alvarez or something like that.
Alzheimer's, I said.
Ah, yeah. Probably I'm getting it myself. Hell, I'm tempted to take you anyway.
You don't need to do that, I said. I can get a ride from Gates easy.
Still, he said, your mother, a stroke, only 48.
He grabbed at the baggy crotch of his pants.
Fucking truss, he cried,
then laughed. The sound was both desperate and amused.
Fucking rupture. If you stick around, son, all your work starts falling apart. God kicks your ass in the end, let me tell you. But you're a good boy to just drop everything and go to her like you're doing.
She's a good mom, I said, and once again I felt the tears bite. I never felt very homesick when I went away to school. A little bit the first week, that was all. But I felt homesick then. There was just me and her, no other close relatives. I couldn't image life without her. Wasn't too bad, Mrs. McCurdy had said. A stroke, but not too bad. Damn old lady better be telling the truth, I thought. She just better be. We rode in silence for a little while. It wasn't the fast ride I'd hoped for. The old man maintained a steady 45 miles an hour, and sometimes wandered over the white line to sample the other lane. But it was a long ride, and that was really just as good. Highway 68 unrolled before us, turning its way through miles of woods and splitting the little towns that were there and gone in a slow blink, each one with its bar and its self-service gas station. New Sharon, Ophelia, West Ophelia, Ganniston, which had once been Afghanistan. Strange but true. Mechanic Falls, Castle View, Castle Rock. The bright blue of the sky dimmed as the day drained out of it. The old man turned on first his parking lights and then his headlights. They were the high beams, but he didn't seem to notice, not even when cars coming the other way flashed their own high beams at him.
My sister-in-law don't even remember her own name, he said. She don't know I, yes, no, nor maybe. That's what that Anderson's disease does to you, son. There's a look in her eyes, like she's saying, let me out of here. Or would say it if she could think of the words. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I said. I took a deep breath and wondered if the pee I smelled was the old man's, or if maybe he had a dog that rode with him sometimes. I wondered if he'd be offended if I rolled down my window a little. Finally, I did. He didn't seem to notice, any more than he noticed the oncoming cars flashing their highs at him. Around 7 o'clock, we breasted a hill in West Gates, and my chauffeur cried,
"Look at son, the moon! Ain't she a corker?"
She was indeed a corker. A huge orange ball hoisting itself over the horizon. I thought there was nevertheless something terrible about it. It looked both pregnant and infected. Looking at the rising moon, a sudden and awful thought came to me. What if I got to the hospital and my ma didn't recognize me? What if her memory was gone, completely shot, and she didn't know I, yes, no, nor maybe? What if the doctor told me she'd need someone to take care of her for the rest of her life? That someone would have to be me, of course. There was no one else. Goodbye, college. What about that, friends and neighbors?
"Make a wish on it, Boyle!" the old man cried.
In his excitement, his voice grew sharp and unpleasant. It was like having shards of glass stuffed into your ear. He gave his crotch a terrific tug. Something in there made a snapping sound. I didn't see how you could yank on your crotch like that and not rip your balls right off of the stem, truss or no truss.
"Wish you make on the harvest moon, always comes true. That's what my father said."
So I wished that my mother would know me when I walked into her room, that her eyes would light up at once and she would say my name. I made that wish,
and immediately wished I could have it back again. I thought that no wish made in that fevery orange light could come to any good.
"Ah, son," the old man said, "I wish my wife was here. I'd beg forgiveness for every sharp and unkind word I ever said to her."
20 minutes later, with the last light of the day still in the air, and the moon still hanging low and bloated in the sky, we arrived in Gates Falls. There's a yellow blinker at the intersection of Route 68 and Pleasant Street. Just before he reached it, the old man swerved to the side of the road, bumping the Dodge's right front wheel up over the curb and then back down again. It rattled my teeth. The old man looked at me with a kind of wild, defiant excitement. Everything about him was wild, although I hadn't seen that at first. Everything about him had that broken glass feeling, and everything that came out of his mouth seemed to be an exclamation.
"I'll take you up there. I will. Yes, sir. Never mind Ralph. Hell with him. You just say the word."
I wanted to get to my mother, but the thought of another 20 miles with the smell of piss in the air and cars flashing their brights at us wasn't very pleasant. Neither was the image of the old fellow wandering and weaving across 4 lanes of Lisbon Street. Mostly, though, it was him. I couldn't stand another 20 miles of crotch-snatching and that excited, broken-glass voice.
"Hey, no," I said. "That's okay. You go on and take care of your brother."
I opened the door, and what I feared happened. He reached out and took hold of my arm with his twisted old man's hand. It was the hand with which he kept tearing at his crotch.
"You just say the word," he told me.
His voice was hoarse, confidential. His fingers were pressing deep into the flesh just below my armpit.
"I'll take you right to the hospital door. Don't matter if I never saw you before in my life, nor you me. Don't matter I, yes, no, nor maybe. I'll take you right there."
"It's okay," I repeated. And all at once, I was fighting an urge to bolt out of the car, leaving my shirt behind in his grip if that's what it took to get free. It was as if he were drowning. I thought that when I moved, his grip would tighten, that he might even go for the nape of my neck. But he didn't. His fingers loosened, then slipped away entirely as I put my leg out. And I wondered, as we always do when an irrational moment of panic passes, what I had been so afraid of in the first place. He was just an elderly carbon-based life form in an elderly Dodge's pea-smelling ecosystem, looking disappointed that his offer had been refused. Just an old man who couldn't get comfortable in his truss. What in God's name had I been afraid of? "I thank you for the ride, and even more for the offer," I said. "But I can go out that way," I pointed at Pleasant Street, "and I'll have a ride in no time." He was quiet for a moment, then sighed and nodded.
Yeah, that's the best way to go," he said. "Stay right out of town. Nobody wants to give a fellow a ride in town. No one wants to slow down and get honked at."
He was right about that. Hitchhiking in town, even a small one like Gates Falls, was futile. I guess he had spent some time riding his thumb.
"But son, are you sure? You know what they say about a bird in the hand."
I hesitated again. He was right about a bird in the hand, too. Pleasant Street became Ridge Road a mile or so west of the blinker, and Ridge Road ran through 15 miles of woods before arriving at Route 196 on the outskirts of Lewiston. It was almost dark, and it's always harder to get a ride at night. When headlights pick you out on a country road, you look like an escapee from Wyndham Boys Correctional, even with your hair combed and your shirt tucked in. But I didn't want to ride with the old man anymore. Even now, when I was safely out of his car, I thought there was something creepy about him. Maybe it was just the way his voice seemed full of exclamation points. Besides, I've always been lucky getting rides.
"I'm sure," I said. "And thanks again, really." "Anytime, son, anytime. My wife..."
He stopped, and I saw there were tears leaking from the corners of his eyes. I thanked him again, then slammed the door shut before I could say anything else. I hurried across the street, my shadow appearing and disappearing in the light of the blinker. On the far side, I turned and looked back. The Dodge was still there, parked beside Frank's fountain and fruits. By the light of the blinker and the streetlight 20 feet or so beyond the car, I could see him sitting slumped over the wheel. The thought came to me that he was dead, that I had killed him with my refusal to let him help. Then a car came around the corner, and the driver flashed his high beams at the Dodge. This time, the old man dipped his own lights, and that was how I knew he was still alive. A moment later, he pulled back into the street and piloted the Dodge slowly around the corner. I watched until he was gone, then looked up at the moon. It was starting to lose its orange bloat, but there was still something sinister about it. It occurred to me that I had never heard of wishing on the moon before. The evening star, yes, but not the moon. I wished again I could take my own wish back. As the dark drew down and I stood there at the crossroads, it was too easy to think of that story about the monkey's paw. I walked out Pleasant Street, waving my thumb at cars that went by without even slowing. At first there were shops and houses on both sides of the road. Then the sidewalk ended and the trees closed in again, silently retaking the land. Each time the road flooded with light, pushing my shadow out ahead of me. I'd turn around, stick out my thumb, and put what I hoped was a reassuring smile on my face. And each time the oncoming car would swoosh by without slowing. Once someone shouted out, "Get a job, monkey meat!" And there was laughter. Now, I'm not afraid of the dark, or wasn't then, but I began to be afraid I'd made a mistake by not taking the old man up on his offer to drive me straight to the hospital. I could have made a sign reading, "Need a ride, mother sick," before starting out, but I doubted if it would have helped. Any psycho can make a sign, after all. I walked along, sneakers scuffing the gravelly dirt of the soft shoulder, listening to the sounds of the gathering night. A dog far away, an owl much closer, the sigh of a rising wind. The sky was bright with moonlight, but I couldn't see the moon itself just now. The trees were tall here and had blotted it out for the time being. As I left Gates Falls farther behind, fewer cars passed me. My decision not to take the old man up on his offer seemed more foolish with each passing minute. I began to imagine my mother in her hospital bed, mouth turned down in a frozen sneer, losing her grip on life but trying to hold on to that increasingly slippery bark for me, not knowing I wasn't going to make it simply because I hadn't liked an old man's shrill voice or the pissy smell of his car. I breasted a steep hill and stepped back into moonlight again at the top. The trees were gone on my right, replaced by a small country graveyard. The stones gleamed in the pale light. Something small and black was crouched beside one of them, watching me. I took a step closer, curious. The black thing moved and became a woodchuck. It spared me a single reproachful red-eyed glance and was gone into the high grass. All at once, I became aware that I was very tired. In fact, close to exhausted. I had been running on pure adrenaline since Mrs. McCurdy called 5 hours before, but now that was gone. That was the bad part. The good part was that useless sense of frantic urgency left me, at least for the time being. I had made my choice, decided on Ridge Road instead of Route 68, and there was no sense beating myself up over it. "Fun is fun and done is done," my mother sometimes said. She was full of stuff like that. Little Zen aphorisms that almost made sense. Sense or nonsense, this one comforted me now. If she was dead when I got to the hospital, that was that. Probably she wouldn't be. Doctor said it wasn't too bad, according to Mrs. McCurdy. Mrs. McCurdy had also said she was still a young woman, a bit on the heavy side, true, and a heavy smoker in the bargain, but still young. Meantime, I was out here in the willy-wags, and I was suddenly tired out. My feet felt as if they had been dipped in cement. There was a stone wall running along the roadside of the cemetery, with a break in it where two ruts ran through. I sat on the wall with my feet planted in one of these ruts. From this position, I could see a good length of Ridge Road in both directions. When I saw headlights coming west in the direction of Lewiston, I could walk back to the edge of the road and put my thumb out. In the meantime, I'd just sit here with my backpack in my lap and wait for some strength to come back into my legs. A ground mist, fine and glowing, was rising out of the grass. The trees surrounding the cemetery on three sides rustled in the rising breeze. From beyond the graveyard came the sound of running water and the occasional plunk-plunk of a frog. The place was beautiful and oddly soothing, like a picture in a book of romantic poems. I looked both ways along the road. Nothing coming, not so much as a glow on the horizon. Putting my pack down in the wheel rut where I'd been dangling my feet, I got up and walked into the cemetery. A lock of hair had fallen onto my brow. The wind blew it off. The mist roiled lazily around my shoes. The stones at the back were old. More than a few had fallen over. The ones at the front were much newer. I bent, hands planted on knees, to look at one which was surrounded by almost fresh flowers. By moonlight, the name was easy to read. George Staub. Below it were the dates marking the brief span of George Staub's life. January 19, 1977 at one end. October 12, 1998 at the other. That explained the flowers, which had only begun to wilt. October 12th was 2 days ago, and 1998 was just 2 years ago. George's friends and relatives had stopped by to pay their respects. Below the name and dates was something else, a brief inscription. I leaned down further to read it, and stumbled back, terrified and all too aware that I was by myself visiting a graveyard by moonlight. Fun is fun, and done is done, was the inscription. My mother was dead, had died perhaps at that very minute, and something had sent me a message. Something with a thoroughly unpleasant sense of humor. I began to back slowly toward the road, listening to the wind in the trees, listening to the stream, listening to the frog, suddenly afraid I might hear another sound. The sound of rubbing earth and tearing roots as something not quite dead reached up, groping for one of my sneakers. My feet tangled together and I fell down, thumping my elbow on a gravestone, barely missing another with the back of my head. I landed with a grassy thud, looking up at the moon which had just barely cleared the trees. It was white instead of orange now, and as bright as a polished bone. Instead of panicking me further, the fall cleared my head. I didn't know what I'd seen, but it couldn't have been what I thought I'd seen. That kind of stuff might work in John Carpenter and Wes Craven movies, but it wasn't the stuff of real life. Yes, okay, good, a voice whispered in my head. And if you just walk out of here now, you can go on believing that. You can go on believing it for the rest of your life. Fuck that, I said, and got up. The seat of my jeans was wet, and I plucked it away from my skin. It wasn't exactly easy to reapproach the stone marking George Staub's final resting place, but it wasn't as hard as I'd expected either. The wind sighed through the trees, still rising, signaling a change in the weather. Shadows danced unsteadily around me, branches rubbed together, a creaky sound off in the woods. I bent over the tombstone and read. George Staub, January 19, 1977, October 12, 1998. Well begun, too soon done. I stood there, leaning down with my hands planted just above my knees, not aware of how fast my heart had been beating until it started to slow down. A nasty little coincidence, that was all. And was it any wonder that I'd misread what was beneath the name and dates? Even without being tired and under stress, I might have read it wrong. Moonlight was a notorious misleader. Case closed. Except I knew what I'd read. Fun is fun and done is done. My ma was dead. Fuck that, I repeated, and turned away. As I did, I realized the mist curling through the grass and around my ankles had begun to brighten. I could hear the mutter of an approaching motor. A car was coming. I hurried back through the opening in the rock wall, snagging my pack on the way by. The lights of the approaching car were halfway up the hill. I stuck out my thumb just as they struck me, momentarily blinding me. I knew the guy was going to stop even before he started slowing down. It's funny how you can just know sometimes, but anyone who's spent a lot of time hitchhiking will tell you that it happens. The car passed me, brake lights flaring, and swerved onto the soft shoulder near the end of the rock wall, dividing the graveyard from Ridge Road. I ran to it with my backpack banging against the side of my knee. The car was a Mustang, one of the cool ones from the late 60s or early 70s. The motor rumbled loudly, the fat sound of it coming through a muffler that maybe wouldn't pass inspection the next time the sticker came due. But that wasn't my problem. I swung the door open and slid inside. As I put my backpack between my feet, an odor struck me. something almost familiar and a trifle unpleasant.
"Thank you," I said. "Thanks a lot." The guy behind the wheel was wearing faded jeans and a black T-shirt with the arms cut off. His skin was tanned, the muscles heavy, and his right bicep was ringed with a blue barbed wire tattoo. He was wearing a green John Deere cap turned around backward. There was a button pinned near the round collar of his T-shirt, but I couldn't read it from my angle.
"Not a problem," he said. "You headed up the city?"
"Yes," I said. In this part of the world, up the city meant Lewiston, the only city of any size north of Portland. As I closed the door, I saw one of those pine tree air fresheners hanging from the rearview mirror. That was what I'd smelled. It sure wasn't my night as far as odors went. First pee and now artificial pine. Still, it was a ride. I should have been relieved. And as the guy accelerated back onto Ridge Road, the big engine of his vintage Mustang growling, I tried to tell myself I was relieved.
"What's going on for you in the city?" the driver asked.
I put him at about my age. Some townie who maybe went to vocational technical school in Auburn, or maybe worked in one of the few remaining textile mills in the area. He'd probably fixed up this Mustang in his spare time, because that's what townie kids did. Drank beer, smoked a little rope, fixed up their cars, or their motorcycles. "My brother's getting married. I'm going to be his best man." I told this lie with absolutely no premeditation. I didn't want him to know about my mother, although I didn't know why. Something was wrong here. I didn't know what it was or why I should think such a thing in the first place. But I knew. I was positive. "The rehearsal's tomorrow, plus a stag party tomorrow night."
"Yeah? That right?"
He turned to look at me. Wide-set eyes and handsome face, full lips smiling slightly. The eyes unbelieving.
"Yeah," I said.
I was afraid. Just like that, I was afraid again. Something was wrong, had maybe started being wrong when the old geezer in the Dodge had invited me to wish on the infected moon instead of on a star. Or maybe from the moment I'd picked up the telephone and listened to Mrs. McCurdy saying she had some bad news for me. But 'twasn't as bad as it could have been.
"Well, that's good," said the young man in the turned-around cap. "A brother getting married, man, that's good. What's your name?"
I wasn't just afraid. I was terrified. Everything was wrong. Everything. And I didn't know why or how it could possibly have happened so fast. I did know one thing, however. I wanted the driver of the Mustang to know my name no more than I wanted him to know my business in Lewiston. Not that I'd be getting to Lewiston. I was suddenly sure that I would never see Lewiston again. It was like knowing the car was going to stop. And there was the smell. I knew something about that as well. It wasn't the air freshener. It was something beneath the air freshener.
"Hector," I said, giving him my roommate's name. "Hector Passmore, that's me."
It came out of my dry mouth, smooth and calm, and that was good. Something inside me insisted that I must not let the driver of the Mustang know that I sensed something wrong. It was my only chance. He turned toward me a little, and I could read his button. "I rode the bullet at Thrill Village, Laconia." I knew the place, had been there, although not for a long time. I could also see a heavy black line which circled his throat, just as the barbed wire tattoo circled his upper arm. Only the line around the driver's throat wasn't a tattoo. Dozens of black marks crossed it vertically. They were the stitches put in by whoever had put his head back on his body.
"Nice to meet you, Hector," he said. "I'm George Staub."
My hands seemed to float out like a hand in a dream. I wished that it had been a dream, but it wasn't. It had all the sharp edges of reality. The smell on top was pine. The smell underneath was some chemical, probably formaldehyde. I was riding with a dead man. The Mustang rushed along Ridge Road at 60 miles an hour, chasing its high beams under the light of a polished button moon. To either side, the trees crowding the road danced and writhed in the wind. George Staub smiled at me with his empty eyes, then let go of my hand and returned his attention to the road. In high school, I'd read Dracula, and now a line from it recurred, clanging in my head like a cracked bell. "The dead drive fast,"
can't let him know I know. This also clanged in my head. It wasn't much, but it was all I had. Can't let him know, can't let him, can't. I wondered where the old man was now. Safe at his brother's? Or had the old man been in on it all along? Was he maybe right behind us, driving along in his old Dodge, hunched over the wheel and snapping at his truss? Was he dead too? Probably not. The dead dry fast, according to Bram Stoker, and the old man had never gone a tick over 45. I felt demented laughter bubbling in the back of my throat and held it down. If I laughed, he'd know, and he mustn't know, because that was my only hope.
"There's nothing like a wedding," he said.
"Yeah," I said. "Everyone should do it at least twice." My hands had settled on each other and were squeezing. I could feel the nails digging into the backs of them just above the knuckles, but the sensation was distant. I couldn't let him know. That was the thing. The woods were all around us. The only light was the heartless bone glow of the moon, and I couldn't let him know that I knew he was dead. Because he wasn't a ghost. Nothing so harmless. You might see a ghost, but what sort of thing stopped to give you a ride? What kind of creature was that? Zombie? Ghoul? Vampire? None of the above? George Staub laughed.
"Do it twice. Yeah, man, that's my whole family."
"Mine too," I said. My voice sounded calm. Just the voice of a hitchhiker passing the time of day, night in this case, making agreeable conversation as some small payment for his ride. "There's really nothing like a funeral." "Wedding," he said mildly. In the light from the dashboard, his face was waxy, the face of a corpse before the makeup went on. That turnaround cap was particularly horrible. It made you wonder how much was left beneath it. I had read somewhere that morticians sawed off the top of the skull and took out the brains and put in some sort of chemically treated cotton to keep the face from falling in, maybe. "Wedding," I said through numb lips, and even laughed a little, a light little chuckle. "Wedding's what I meant to say."
"We always say what we mean to say, that's what I think," the driver said. He was still smiling.
Yes, Freud had believed that too. I'd read it in Psych 101. I doubted this fellow knew much about Freud. I didn't think many Freudian scholars wore sleeveless t-shirts and baseball caps turned around backward. But he knew enough. "Funeral," I'd said. Dear Christ, I'd said funeral. It came to me then that he was playing me. I didn't want to let him know that I knew he was dead. He didn't want to let me know that he knew I knew he was dead, and so I couldn't let him know that I knew that he knew that. The world began to swing in front of me. In a moment, it would begin to spin, then to whirl, and I'd lose it. I closed my eyes for a moment. In the darkness, the afterimage of the moon hung, turning green.
"You feeling all right, man?"
he asked. The concern in his voice was gruesome.
"Yes," I said, opening my eyes.
Things had steadied again. The pain in the backs of my hands where the nails were digging into the skin was strong and real. And the smell. Not just pine air freshener, not just chemicals. There was a smell of earth as well.
"You sure?"
he asked. "Just a little tired. Been hitchhiking a long time, and sometimes I get a little car sick." Inspiration suddenly struck. "You know what? I think you better let me out. If I get a little fresh air, my stomach will settle. Someone else will come along and..."
"I couldn't do that," he said. "Leave you out here? No way. It could be an hour before someone came along, and they might not pick you up when they did. I gotta take care of you. What's that song? Get me to the church on time, right? No way I'm letting you out. Crack your window a little, that'll help. I know it doesn't smell exactly great in here. I hung up that air freshener, but those things don't work worth a shit. Of course, some smells are harder to get rid of than others."
I wanted to reach out for the window crank and turn it, let in the fresh air, but the muscles in my arm wouldn't seem to tighten. All I could do was sit there with my hands locked together, nails biting into the back of them. One set of muscles wouldn't work, another wouldn't stop working. What a joke.
"It's like that story," he said. "The one about the kid who buys the almost new Cadillac for $750. You know that story, don't you?"
"Yeah," I said through my numb lips. I didn't know the story, but I knew perfectly well I didn't want to hear it. Didn't want to hear any story this man might have to tell.
"That one's famous."
Ahead of us, the road leaped forward like a road in an old black-and-white movie.
Yeah, it is fucking famous. So the kid's looking for a car, and he sees an almost brand new Cadillac on this guy's lawn.
I said I...
Yeah, and there's a sign that says, for sale by owner, in the window.
There was a cigarette parked behind his ear. He reached for it, and when he did, his shirt pulled up in the front. I could see another puckered black line there. More stitches. Then he leaned forward to punch in the cigarette lighter, and the shirt dropped back into place.
Kid knows he can't afford no Cadillac car. Can't get within a shout of a caddy. But he's curious, you know? So he goes over to the guy and says, how much does something like that go for? And the guy, he turns off the hose he's got because he's washing the car, you know, and he says, kid, this is your lucky day. $750 and you drive it away.
The cigarette lighter popped out. Staub pulled it free and pressed the coil to the end of his cigarette. He drew in smoke, and I saw little tendrils come seeping out between the stitches holding the incision on his neck closed.
The kid, he looks in through the driver's side window and sees his only 17 thou in the odometer. He says to the guy, yeah, sure, that's as funny as a screen door in a submarine. The guy says, no joke, kid, pony up the cash and it's yours. Hell, I'll even take a check. You got an honest face. And the kid says...
I looked out the window. I had heard the story before, years ago, probably when I was still in junior high. In the version I've been told, the car was a Thunderbird instead of a Caddy, but otherwise, everything was the same. The kid says, I may only be 17, but I'm not an idiot. No one sells a car like this, especially one with low mileage, for only $750. And the guy tells him he's doing it because the car smells. You can't get the smell out. He's tried and tried, and nothing will take it out. You see, he was on a business trip, a fairly long one, gone for at least a couple of weeks, the driver was saying. He was smiling the way people do when they're telling a joke that really slays them. And when he comes back, he finds the car in the garage and his wife in the car. She's been dead practically the whole time he's been gone. I don't know if it was suicide or a heart attack or what, but she's all bloated up. And the car, it's full of that smell. And all he wants to do is sell it, you know? He laughed. That's quite a story, huh?
Why wouldn't he call home? It was my mouth, talking all by itself. My brain was frozen. He's gone for 2 weeks on a business trip. And he never calls home once to see how his wife's doing?
Well, the driver said, that's sort of beside the point, wouldn't you say? I mean, hey, what a bargain. That's the point. Who wouldn't be tempted? After all, you could always drive the car with the fucking windows open, right? And it's basically just a story. Fiction. I thought of it because of the smell in this car. Which is fact.
Silence. And I thought, he's waiting for me to say something. Waiting for me to end this. And I wanted to, I did, except, what then? What would he do then? He rubbed the ball of his thumb over the button on his shirt, the one reading, I rode the bullet at Thrill Village, Laconia. I saw there was dirt under his fingernails.
That's where I was today, he said. Thrill Village. I did some work for a guy, and he gave me an all-day pass. My girlfriend was going to go with me, but she called and said she was sick. She gets these periods that really hurt sometimes. They make her sick as a dog. It's too bad, but I always think, hey, what's the alternative? No rag at all, right? And then I'm in trouble. We both are. Ha! He yapped, a humorless bark of sound. So I went by myself. No sense wasting an all-day pass. You ever been to Thrill Village?
Yes, I said. Once, when I was 12.
Who'd you go with? He asked. You didn't go alone, did you? Not if you were only 12.
I hadn't told him that part, had I?
No.
He was playing with me, that was all, swatting me idly back and forth. I thought about opening the door and just rolling out into the night, trying to tuck my head into my arms before I hit. Only I knew he'd reach over and pull me back before I could get away. And I couldn't raise my arms anyway. The best I could do was clutch my hands together. No, I said. I went with my dad. My dad took me.
Did you ride the bullet?
I rode that fucker 4 times. Man, it goes right upside down. He looked at me and uttered another empty bark of laughter. The moonlight swam in his eyes, turning them into white circles, making them into the eyes of a statue. And I understood he was more than dead. He was crazy.
Did you ride that, Alan?
I thought of telling him he had the wrong name. My name was Hector. But what was the use? We were coming to the end of it now.
Yeah, I whispered.
Not a single light out there, except for the moon.
The trees rushed by, writhing like spontaneous dancers at a tent show revival. The road rushed under us. I looked at the speedometer and saw he was up to 80 miles an hour. We were riding the bullet right now, he and I. The dead drive fast.
Yeah, the bullet. I rode it.
Nah, he said. He drew on his cigarette, and once again I watched the little trickles of smoke escape from the stitched incision on his neck.
You never. Especially not with your father. You got into the line all right, but you were with your ma. The line was long, the line for the bullet always is, and she didn't want to stand out there in the hot sun. She was fat even then, and the heat bothered her. But you pestered her all day. Pested, pested, pested. And here's the joke of it, man. When you finally got to the head of the line, you chickened, didn't you?
I said nothing. My tongue was stuck to the roof of my mouth. His hands stole out, the skin yellow in the light of the Mustang's dashboard lights, the nails filthy, and gripped my locked hands. The strength went out of them when he did, and they fell apart like a knot that magically unties itself with the touch of the magician's wand. His skin was cold and somehow snaky.
Didn't ya?
Yes, I said. I couldn't get my voice much above a whisper. When we got close and I saw how high it was, how it turned over at the top, and how they screamed inside when it did, I chickened out. She swatted me, and she wouldn't talk to me all the way home. I never rode the bullet.
Until now, at least. You should have, man. That's the best one. That's the one to ride. Nothing else is as good. At least not there. I stopped on the way home and got some beers at that store by the state line. I was going to stop over at my girlfriend's house, give her the button as a joke.
He tapped the button on his chest, then unrolled his window and flicked his cigarette out into the windy night.
Only you probably know what happened.
Of course I knew. It was every ghost story you'd ever heard, wasn't it? He crashed his Mustang, and when the cops got there, he'd been sitting dead in the crumpled remains with his body behind the wheel and his head in the back seat, his cap turned around backward and his dead eyes staring up at the roof. And ever since, you see him on Ridge Road, when the moon is full and the wind is high. Whew. We will return after this brief word from our sponsor. I know something now that I didn't before. The worst stories are the ones you've heard your whole life. Those are the real nightmares.
Nothing like a funeral, he said and laughed. Isn't that what you said? You slipped there, Al. No doubt about it. Slipped, tripped, and fell.
Let me out, I whispered. Please.
Well, he said, turning toward me, we have to talk about that, don't we? Do you know who I am, Alan?
You're a ghost, I said. He gave an impatient little snort, and in the glow of the speedometer, the corners of his mouth turned down.
Come on, man, you can do better than that. Fucking Casper's a ghost. Do I float in the air? Can you see through me?
He held up one of his hands, opened and closed it in front of me. I could hear the dry, unlubricated sound of his tendons creaking. I tried to say something, I don't know what, and it doesn't really matter because nothing came out.
I'm kind of a messenger, Staub said. Fucking FedEx from beyond the grave. You like that? Guys like me actually come out pretty often, whenever the circumstances are just right. You know what I think? I think that whoever runs things, God or whatever, must like to be entertained. He always wants to see if you'll keep what you already got, or if it can talk you into going for what's behind the curtain. Things have to be just right, though. Tonight they were. You out all by yourself, mother sick, needing a ride.
If I'd stayed with the old man, none of this would have happened, I said. Would it? I could smell Staub clearly now, the needle-sharp smell of the chemicals, and the duller, blunter stink of decaying meat, and wondered how I ever could have missed it, or mistaken it for something else.
Hard to say, Staub replied. Maybe this old man you're talking about was dead, too.
I thought of the old man's shrill, handful-of-glass voice, the snap of his truss. No, he hadn't been dead, and I had traded the smell of piss in his old Dodge for something a lot worse.
Anyway, man, we don't have time to talk about all that. 5 more miles and we'll start seeing houses again. 7 more and we're at the Lewiston City line, which means you have to decide now.
Decide what? only I thought I knew.
Who rides the bullet and who stays on the ground? You or your mother?